Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of the Open Minds podcast. I'm so excited to share this episode with you. I talked to Professor Michael Geist out of the University of Ottawa. Michael's a law professor, and we talk about the Government of Canada's recent bills, Bill C-11, Bill C-18, and a strange Liberal Party policy convention idea, all of which taken together show the government will have an increased role in your digital life. Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. You know, since the COVID-19 pandemic, and perhaps even before, there's been a real concern about online misinformation and disinformation spreading. And many civil society organizations and individuals have called on government to take a more active role in our digital lives as a result. Perhaps the fear is that spreading this misinformation or disinformation could lead people to protest, write letters, believe false narratives, and perhaps even on extreme cases, enact some form of violence, whether towards publicly elected officials or towards other members of society as a result. Perhaps this is why the Government of Canada has enacted various bills and party policy conventions that align with the government's more active role in our digital lives. Bill C-11 here in Canada seeks for the government to push more Canadian content through online streaming services like Netflix and YouTube. And there are considerations for Canadian content creators, myself included. So I wanted to talk to an expert about this to break down both the government's thinking and what these bills mean, and perhaps what this also means for our global society writ large, with governments having a more active role in our digital lives. Professor Michael Geist out of the University of Ottawa has been an open critic on the government's bills because there is this tension between the government's action and freedom of expression. I can't wait to share this one with you. Definitely check it out at www.openmindspodcast.com. I'll have an article associated with this episode as well. Check me out on Instagram and TikTok. Instagram at Open Minds Pod and TikTok at Open Minds Podcast. I'll be posting clips of this conversation there, and I can't wait to share this with all of you. I hope you enjoy it. Michael, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast. I wanted to begin by asking you, there has been this shift I've seen in the recent past by the federal government, seemingly to have a more pronounced say on Canadians' online activities. And I wanted to know, is this a new phenomenon, or is this something governments have generally been invested in Canadians' expressions, freedom of expressions online?
Sure. So thanks for having me on the podcast. And it's a good way to start us off. You know, I think that, you know, governments have been engaged in some forms of internet policy and internet regulation for a long time, going back really to the emergence of the internet as a popular forum back in the 1990s. I think it's fair to say that for most of probably the first two decades of Canadian internet policy, it was much more of a hands-off approach. You know, the prevailing view was this was an innovative space. There were great opportunities that government, to the extent to which it had the power to regulate, it was more appropriate to take more of a hands-off approach. And I think it is fair to say that under the current government, over the last few years, we've seen a pretty significant shift. And you're right to say that suddenly now we've got a government that is much more attentive to the prospect of regulating. I think there are a few factors behind that. It would include things like some of the world events, the events a number of years ago, for example, the shootings in Christchurch, and which sort of put the spotlight on some of the harms that we see times taking place. Pressure or new policies coming out of Europe that I think the Canadian government was oftentimes interested in replicating. So there's been a number of different activities, incidents, and that have really, I think, sparked a bit of a rethink. And for the last few years, it's really a 180-degree shift in the sense that the Canadian government is much more aggressive about regulating online behavior. And that has sparked some significant concern as to whether or not, in a sense, the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction, and some of the implications of their choices raise some real concerns.
Michael, I want to explore those instances a little bit more with you. I know it's not may not be your area of expertise, but I'm always fascinated by wondering whether or not instances of extreme events, terrorism, innocent lives being killed, the fact that that's happening online, let's just say a mass shooting in a mosque, someone writes a manifesto, posts it to Facebook, the next day they live stream a mass shooting in a mosque, and suddenly it brings out a lot of civil society organizations, Muslim-based organizations and others, to say governments need to step in and do more in regulating the internet and making sure this kind of instance doesn't happen again. I would assume most reasonable people would agree with that. However, I'm not too sure whether the frequency of extreme events like that have amplified because of social media and the internet, and that they would happen, subtract the internet, they would happen regardless. I know that might be a very cold way of looking at scenarios, but is that a fair assessment, or has there been a market shift with the advent of internet and social media with these types of events?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question to ask. You know, obviously at a certain level, it's tough to prove the negative. You know, we don't know what would have happened but for.
Correct.
I would say, I think there is a reasoned and reasonable view that the internet, you know, which was once viewed with a bit of rose-colored glasses, I think, about the benefits, does present a series of risks, and that these are some of them, and that, you know, the amplification that we do see from social media, the ease with which people connect to one another, does raise some real concerns. And it's not just, you know, you cited the Muslim community, the Jewish mm-hmm. community faces it, many groups, minority groups, vulnerable groups, you know, see some of the vitriol that takes place online and have real concerns. In fact, I would say in a Canadian context, one of the incidents that I think brought the issue home to many politicians was the abuse that former Liberal cabinet minister Catherine McKenna faced online. And McKenna was right. environment minister for a period of time. She faced, you know, just, you know, terrible misogyny, I think, online, and some of that spilled over into the offline world. And when right. you spoke to members of parliament, very often they would reference the experience that McKenna had. It, I think in some way it personalized the experience that a lot of other people feel. So right. I don't think there's much to be gained by understating the risk. There are some that would suggest no, that, you know, let's be cognizant of freedom of expression and recognize that much of this stuff will happen with or without the online environment. I think even if you take that position, if there are steps that we can take that will mm-hmm. make it a safer environment that ensures as broad participation as possible, so much the better. That mm-hmm. still doesn't mean that I think the government is getting it right. I think I don't believe they're getting it right. And I think that they are overstepping when it comes to freedom of expression. But that, you know, sometimes I get accused of wanting this kind of non-regulated Wild West. And that's not the case. I think there is a role to play from a regulatory perspective. But I don't think that some of the proposed solutions we've seen from the government on some of these issues has been the right way to go.
Before we get into what the government of Canada has done, and again, in the last few months, it seems things are just happening so quickly, and it's sometimes hard to stay on top of the implications because they're happening so quickly. And nefariously, I sometimes think, do governments do these in waves to make sure that people don't have the time to really really fester over them and let them marinate? But there is research, and there, you know, it just makes sense. You know, when governments go down the path of trying to regulate speech in any way, there is that constant battle between civil rights and protecting the community. And, you know, here's a question. How do you in government navigate that really complicated minefield when you know that there will be a, on some level, a limitation of someone's civil rights and liberties?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the starting point is to recognize that there are those trade-offs. And I must admit that I feel at times the government has given short shrift to the freedom of expression related concerns. And I don't know if that's because they think that there's votes in sort of taking an aggressive position with respect to the platforms and regulating, or whether they whether there's a genuine belief that, you know, they're that these kind of sacrifices or limitations on charter rights are acceptable given the harms that they believe are out there. Regardless, I think we are in an environment right now where it does feel as if the concerns that sometimes arise from a constitutional perspective, sometimes trade perspective, just even basic freedom of expression type issues, is often viewed, I think, as secondary. And there is a willingness to say, yeah, that's an issue, but, and, you know, the but invariably involves choices that I think can raise some pretty significant issues.
Yeah, that the choices definitely do raise significant issues, especially now in this environment where more Canadians are online than ever before. It's not something where you might have had the TV on in the background and you had your computer off to the side. Now it's the computer and the internet is our living room. It is our news source. It's our evening entertainment. It's our place where we check up on our friends and family members. It is so many aspects of our lives now than ever before. So whatever the government does enact, it has a real implication on the day-to-day lives of Canadians. Why do you think the government can dance with these issues, with the impact it has on Canadians, and still seemingly not make it top of mind on news cycles or top of mind for most Canadians when it comes to this?
A question I've asked myself a lot, just because I try to get people engaged. And at times these issues resonate, and at other times, you're right, they just don't seem to hit the mark. I mean, I think part of this is just the reality that, you know, people are busy, especially in challenging economic times. People have other concerns, and politicians and the political world and internet policy just takes a back seat. And I think understandably so. You know, I was doing a joint course with students from a number of different countries, and and part of the reflection, and there were Israeli students and Italian students, and the Israeli students, you know, looked at the Canadian environment where we had the chance to debate, you know, regulations around services like Netflix, and said, you know, you're in a privileged position to be spending a couple of years debating those kinds of issues, that, you know, in some ways there are other issues that are more top of mind for us locally, and they're more existential from a security perspective and otherwise. And here in Canada, for, I think for many Canadians, there are bigger issues, you know, at least day to day, but these are issues with enormous implications, I think, both today and longer term, certainly for the economy in terms of, you know, the kinds of services that we have and the opportunities that present themselves, but even more so for the individual liberties that Canadians have when it comes to this online environment, which provides just this incredible new opportunity that can be seen as scary to some and, you know, wondrous to others, but really does provide people with platforms such as this one to speak out and reach audience in ways that previously wasn't possible before, to actively participate in communities and in policies in ways that was almost limited to the privileged few that had either access or proximity to power or access to the printing presses, so to speak. And to see those, that kind of sea change, I think is phenomenal. And ensuring that we preserve as much of that as possible, while at the same time ensuring that it's a safe space for people, I think ought to be the goal and the objective on some of these policy measures.
Mm-hmm. Michael, over the past 6 months, there's three main policy, either party resolutions and policies that the government has put forward, which we'll discuss. Before we get into the details, I wanted to ask you, for the average Canadian, taken together, Bill C-11, Bill C-18, and the recent Liberal Party resolution, which the Prime Minister walked away from, but taken together, why should the average Canadian be very concerned about these three policy proposals and policy moves?
Yeah, no. They cling together, but there are different issues with each one. And, right. You know, the clinging together, as I think you've highlighted with your early questions, is that this does feel like it is a significant shift in the government's approach to regulating the space. And mm-hmm. I think there justifiably are some real concerns, both about the specific measures that the government has in mind, who they are tasking with providing the oversight and review, the broadcast regulator, the CRTC in some of these cases, and frankly, the concerns that much of this feels like capture from legacy providers and mm-hmm. more powerful lobby groups who I think oftentimes will look at this environment and see it with a certain amount of dread. That they see mm-hmm. new competitors coming to the fore, new challenges to their business models, and you know the extent to which some of this is people in those positions basically using the levers of power that they have for now to try to convince government to establish regulatory frameworks that I think provide benefits to some of those legacy providers, then I think that's part of what is happening. And I think that does raise for the average Canadian some real concerns. You know, in the case of Bill C-11, and we'll come to each of these, I know, but in the case mm-hmm. of Bill C-11, I think the focus there on regulating user content when we have millions of Canadians actively engaged on services like TikTok and YouTube and on podcasts and a range of other mm-hmm. kinds of things. And the idea that we would have a broadcast regulator treating that content as the same as essentially any other content that you might find on a conventional television or radio station, I think raises concerns. The case of Bill C-18, which I know will come to, dealing with the Online News Act and seeking to require Facebook and Google to pay for links to news mm-hmm. content. This raises both enormous concerns about essentially requiring mandated payments for links, which I think really is core to the free flow of information online. It raises mm-hmm. concerns about some of the new, more innovative digital-only news services that I think may struggle to operate online, that in some ways it's the legacy players that are looking for certain advantages. And then the risks of the response from some of these platforms, where certainly at minimum Facebook and Google may as well say that they are getting out of the news business and going to stop linking if the requirement is to pay hundreds of millions for links. And so mm-hmm. that, I think, raises concerns for how Canadians access information on some of those services. And then lastly, you mentioned that Liberal Party resolution, which was, well, just frankly, a really weird situation. Mm-hmm. But it again highlighted, I think, in some ways, concerns around misinformation and disinformation, and just how difficult it is to deal with what is, I think, viewed rightly as a legitimate issue, but mm-hmm. one that is so intertwined with basic expression rights, oftentimes dealing with what is still protected speech, that right. it's very difficult to come up with solutions that will work and that will also pass constitutional muster. Yes. And I think in this case, we had a Liberal Party proposal that, you know, I think was even recognized how it got through, I don't quite understand, but I think it was recognized by some as really just a bad idea that needed to be walked away from as quickly as possible.
Correct. So, Michael, I'd like to start there, actually. So in, I believe it was April or May of this year, the Liberal Party, without debate at its convention, passed a policy resolution to combat, as you mentioned, online disinformation. The resolution called for the party to, quote unquote, explore options to hold online information services accountable for the veracity of material published, as well to limit publication only to material whose sources can be traced. And I just found this to be so fascinating that this could actually be put forward, because the knee-jerk reaction to me is that if I'm a journalist, there is this journalistic integrity piece. So if I'm covering a story and a confidential informant lets me know what's happening, let's say in an area of Toronto, as an example, the fact that I can't trace that source, that publication cannot be published as a result, just boggles my mind. To me, that's the core piece of journalistic integrity. What was your initial reaction when you saw this resolution pass at the Liberal Party convention?
Yeah, well, I must admit, I was surprised because there was a part of me that thought throughout the kind of couple days that this played out that surely someone was going to notice what was taking place and say that this was nuts and that this was not something to go forward with. And so it was brought to my attention, the Liberal convention, I think, opened on the Wednesday or the Thursday. It was brought to my attention on the Thursday, and I blogged about it, and it began to get a fair amount of attention throughout the day on Friday. And I must admit, even when I was writing about it and tweeting about it and you know, otherwise engaging on the policy, sort of, I still somehow expected that someone was going to pay enough attention to say, at a minimum, even if you think this is dealing with a real issue that you want to have addressed, it is so open to very risky, dangerous interpretations that it just can't pass in the form that it was proposed. And, you know, that kind of moment never came. And, you know, past, I think they had breaking work groups kind of thing, and it passed that. And then it went the following day to the broader conference, and again passed, as you say, without vote, and was even ranked, I think, amongst the top 10 or so of the policy resolutions that they had. Now, certainly some within the party say, listen, this is just the reality of how policy takes place from a grassroots perspective. But even there, I think, you know, for one, surely ought have been people that paid some amount of attention to this and sort of said, hold on a second, this is just a bad idea. And there was there was talk, and there was better known journalists than I, that's for sure. I mean, a law professor, but you know, you have Paul Wells and others who were sounding the alarm saying, you know, this is not a great idea. Are you sure this is what you want to go ahead with? And they still went ahead with it. And then even after it started to blow up, you had certain Liberal members of parliament who still defended it. And so that, I think, is for some why there is still some amount, you know, kind of pause here that yes, Prime Minister and others have tried to distance themselves and say, this is not what we intend to do. But the fact that it did get through that process and that people, you know, that there wasn't someone there that, you know, recognized what was happening and would have found a way to at least ensure that there was some more robust debate. And then even after it passes, you've got MPs who speak in favor of it. And then clearly, internally, there may have been some amount of pressure, and they say, oh, now I looked a little closer at it and I've got concerns. I mean, come on. You know, if you did this with legislation, it would be, I think, truly negligent from a member of parliament perspective. And I don't think it's a whole lot better if that's what you do or allow to be passed at your own policy convention. Surely, before you make public statements in favor of a policy resolution, you've got an obligation to read it carefully and understand it. And so if you did do that and you came away thinking it was a good idea, well, then you can understand why there would be some public concern.
Yeah. You know, I mean, in Canada, we just love the word, or some love the word regulation. I just wonder in the future, if we think about this in terms of the major parties, Liberals and Conservatives, to before resolutions are passed, there's some type of fact check or some type of oversight that before things are voted on. Because I can see, you know, something can happen in the news and we automatically as humans think of the most egregious policy recommendation to solve that issue. And that can easily pass a party convention for, especially if it's very partisan or one-sided. But for the benefit of Canadians, we do need that sober second thought, kind of like the Roman Empire with the Senate being like, put forward your ideas and the Senate will oversee and kind of provide the logos, the rational thought to it. I wonder if we can do something like that with the Liberals and Conservatives to say, put everything you can to stick against the wall and we'll go over it to see what actually is worthwhile putting forward on the party floor.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's great. There is this kind of grassroots policy development process, but
yes,
you know, if to the extent to which this really does make it into your policy handbook, so to speak, and then later into your platforms. And we've got plenty of experience in past incidents where that's what's happened. It's, things often do start here that mm-hmm. I think at a minimum, surely those within the party can understand why there are people that looked at this and have some amount of fear that, you know, even if you move away from it today, is this in a sense an advanced preview of what we have to look forward to tomorrow? And, you know, the press was concerned with it, even beyond the press, though. I mean, you're right to highlight this idea of focusing on sources and the implications that would have for the press. But, you know, even to the extent to which the goal here, and this is sort of the proponent, the person who was behind policy, said, no, well, that's not really what we had in mind. What we really had in mind was the platforms playing more aggressive role. Well, even there, do we really want these large platforms to vet and require, you know, oversight, essentially an editorial function over millions and millions of tweets and posts and the like? I think that raises its own set of concerns that we ought to be thinking about.
Michael, before we move on to the two bills that I'd love to talk to you about, what do you think are some of the underlying thought process that could put forward a policy idea like this and also get others to rally behind? Because, you know, on the surface, it's to combat online disinformation, which again, I think most of us would agree, that's a bad thing. But it's the content of the policy that, again, seemed to spark debate, but people seem to love the idea. And as you mentioned, Liberal MPs were defending it. What are some of those underlying thoughts and pillars that people kind of say, that's why we need to have this policy in place?
Yeah, well, I think we're at a time right now where, especially with this government, where there has been, I think, so much criticism of the big tech platforms. And I think there's plenty of reasons to criticize them. I think, ironically, the government has failed to focus on the issues that I think are most salient and where it would be best positioned to do something about it. So, for example, the collection of our data and privacy protections or anti-competitive behavior. That's where I think the federal government is best positioned to deal with these things, as opposed to the approach that we've seen, which has been more focused on content regulation and things like that, which I think is a mistake. But I think when you come in that environment and you say, you know, you've sort of arrived at the conclusion that these platforms are bad, and so we need regulation, and there isn't much regard for the limits of that regulation so long as they're trying to circumscribe some of the activities of those platforms, you end up with the possibility of stuff that just is way out of bounds. And I think that's largely where we're at. So people will say, listen, misinformation, disinformation is a problem. Well, I mean, even with that, and it is, but even that statement fails to account for the fact that misinformation and disinformation are not the same thing. You know, misinformation may deal with information that is inaccurate, but is still lawful speech. It is what we often refer to as lawful but awful speech. And the ability to establish strong limitations, legal limitations on what is lawful speech is, I think, rightly limited. It's lawful speech for a reason. Now, that's different from disinformation, where we're typically talking about an intent to deceive. And there may well be the ability to deal with disinformation campaigns where there is knowledge that the information is false, and that's an intentional act to try to deceive people. Well, if you're doing that with the hope of creating some harm or personal gain, well, then I can well see why some would say that it's appropriate to engage in some amount of regulation. But, you know, that's not what we were talking about in this case. In this case, it was, there's just a lot of speech we don't think is appropriate on these platforms, and we want the platforms to have to exercise some sort of editorial judgment. And the way they landed on it was this requirement to publish sources, and that, of course, spilled immediately over onto with the journalists that they would say are appropriate. And that was one of the interesting things I thought about the response that came. It said, we know, we trust in certain journalists and they're okay. But you know what? It is not up to the government. It is not up to the Liberal Party. It's not up to the person who proposed this to decide who the good journalists are and who the bad journalists are, and establish rules that they figure they can identify the bad journalists. I mean, it's just, that's not the way this works.
Correct. Michael, do you think it's because also that the internet has really social media has matured? So, you know, I remember when YouTube first came out and it was like this place for cat videos and humor videos and fail army videos. But now I would say that there is a more of a chance that Canadians are going on to the platforms like YouTube, so Instagram, social, TikTok, and others for voices, let's say myself, to shed light on things like Bill C-11, Bill C-18, and the Liberal Party Convention. They're not going to CTV, CBC, Global News, etc. And because of that access, the government feels like they're losing a bit of control and they don't fully understand the power of social media. So undertaking this party policy convention is in fact their way of saying, let's rein this in a little bit more and make you, hold you to a much higher standard because we don't fully get the pull of social media.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting observation. You know, I think it's certainly the case that there are some MPs that get it and then there are other members of parliament that do not. That's to be sure. Some are more tech savvy and more experienced with this environment, more comfortable with it than some others are. I think more broadly with respect to the government, I think there is a perception that this is a threat to be countered. That's, I think, increasingly the perspective on this. And that's a pretty significant change. It was not, of course, always that way. It was a much more positive perspective on it. And I think that there are threats there. But the idea that somehow we're going back to, I don't know, 1989 or to the year 2000 or to some sort of pre-internet period where, you know, there was a certain class of people that we could trust and certain media that we could trust. And things were better then because you had limited number of people speaking and you had and you could trust what they had to say. I'm not convinced that that's the case. I think that we are far better off having platforms that allow far more engagement and activity and more creativity and more commercial opportunities and more public engagement. And I think government and some of the people who are proponents for some of these kinds of solutions have struggled with, as you suggest, have struggled with that kind of world. In which there will be people who will have very large audiences who are saying things that they just fundamentally disagree with and sometimes think is just so wrong that they think that there must be something wrong with the system that people have these kinds of platforms and audiences and the ability to say that. Now, none of this is to say that it's a good thing if people are using these platforms for illegal purposes. In fact, no, it's not a good thing. We need to ensure that we've got tools and rules to be able to deal with it. But oftentimes that's not where we are. We're in stuff where there are disagreements and different perspectives on issues. And these platforms have enabled more people to give voice to their perspectives. And it's clear that some are left somewhat uncomfortable with that.
And, you know, often I think we forget that people, you know, there will be extremes, right? People will go online. There are some people who will go online and engage in nefarious activity, you know, dark web, et cetera, et cetera. There are people who will do that, but the vast majority will not engage in that and they will not engage in that type of behavior. So sometimes I feel like there's a misnomer about online behavior. It's almost like categorizing everyone as going on to the dark web and, you know, creating these splinter groups to take over the world or something.
I think that's right. I just quickly note that, listen, in some ways I think that, you know, the internet today, especially, you know, more than two decades after it became more broadly and popularly used, is a mirror of our own societies. And so you're right, of course. The average person, most people are good people who want to get on with their lives and will engage on issues here or there, but are not part of the kind of are not part of this dialogue at either end of the spectrum. But we have a tendency to focus on the extremes at times on either side, as opposed to the vast majority, and that's true, I think, offline, and I think it's become true online as well.
Correct, Michael. I want to pivot to Bill C-11. I understand the government wants to see more Canadian content on our streaming services. So if you, you know, if you've got a Netflix account, if you have YouTube, or any other streaming service, there's this need to put forward more Canadian-based creators, Canadian cultural content, etc. Kind of like I remember as a child, you know, watching TV Ontario here in Ontario and seeing documentaries about Nunavut, Northwest Territories, the Indigenous communities, etc. I can understand how many Canadian content creators, cultural content creators, get lost in the mix of everything that's going being posted onto Netflix and YouTube, and there's a push by the Canadian government to highlight those that content. But yet, Bill C-11 just felt a bit awkward and strange in its enacting. Can you walk folks through what Bill C-11 is and what, again, some of the underlying thought processes that went behind putting it forward?
Sure. So I think we're dealing with at least a couple of issues here. I mean, so this is the Online Streaming Act, and it was framed by the government as an attempt to update Canada's broadcasting laws. And the argument was that these broadcasting laws, which of course regulate broadcasters, radio, television, what are known as broadcast distribution undertakings or BDUs, that would include cable and satellite companies. And the argument was there was a need to update that for the internet age for internet streamers. Now, there are two types of internet streamers, and even in your question, you kind of conflated them a little bit. There's the Netflixes of the world. So let's think of those as curated services. Those would include Disney and Amazon and a number, quite a number of other ones, Crave. Services that make that decide for themselves. They decide what content is available. They commission it, right. They license it, whatever you happen, right. Whatever it happens to be. Then there is a series of platforms that are largely user content platforms. That would be YouTube, right. For the most part, although even there are exceptions even within those platforms. But YouTube, yeah. For the most part, would be a user content platform, TikTok, Instagram, and others. The government, when it first introduced this legislation, said it was interested in regulating the first group. It said, we're interested in the Netflixes and Disneys of the world. We want them to contribute in the same way that a conventional broadcaster does. We want to ensure that there's Canadian content or CanCon on those services. And they said, we are going to exclude the user content. We're not going to regulate users in the same way that we would other right. broadcasters. We're also going to exclude regulating their content. Along the way, they made a change and they removed one of those exceptions or safeguards. And so suddenly you found that while users would not be regulated as broadcasters, as you as a podcaster would not be required to appear before the CRTC, your content could be regulated. And so there were certain powers established that the podcast itself is treated as something potentially subject to regulation. The podcaster is not. I would argue that's largely a distinction without a difference. If you're regulating the content, it has the effect of regulating the individual who created that content in the first place.
Right.
So we've got these two buckets, and I think there are issues with both. On the user side, there is, as I say, real concerns about the prospect that the government gets involved in regulating that kind of content, in part because I think that really is just speech in the way that mm-hmm. prior generations might have sent letters or faxes or used a number of different tools to make their views known or to communicate. Today, many will do it using, or blogs, I guess. Today, many will use it with TikTok or with Instagram right. or on YouTube or through a podcast. And so the idea mm-hmm. that the government would regulate that kind of content, even if it was for nothing more than saying we want the regulator to order these platforms to prioritize certain content and in effect deprioritize other content, which I think raises itself some serious issues, mm-hmm. I think sparked a lot of concern. I think mm-hmm. there is also, and we're starting to see that play out now that the bill's been passed, concerns about some of its approaches with the large streamers as well. So it wants, for example, these what are known as discoverability rules, requirements that a service, let's say like Netflix, ensures that Canadian content is broadly discoverable, findable by individuals. But yet the regulator, the CRTC, has started off by saying, well, we want you to do that not just in Canada, but globally. Somehow the Canadian mm-hmm. content has to be discoverable by all Netflix users in every country around the world. And it says that for all streaming services. It's a global obligation, which both I don't think makes any sense, and also raises the prospect of If Canada says this, well, what's to stop any other country from saying the same thing? And suddenly your feed is actually driven largely by regulation from 50 or 100 countries, as opposed to reflecting some of your own interests. Mm-hmm. And to top right. that off, the starting point for this legislation is that all streaming services anywhere in the world are all subject to Canadian regulation. If it programs audiovisual content, no matter where it is all subject to Canadian rules. It will be up to the regulator, the CRTC, to establish some thresholds and some exceptions. Basically, it will establish some rules that say if the amount of revenue you generate, let's say in Canada, is below a certain threshold, then you're exempted from some of these rules. But the idea that our starting point is that everybody is in, unless a regulator says they're out, and that Parliament didn't even provide guidance on what those thresholds ought to be, I think raise a whole series of concerns as well.
Michael, I can understand why there's a push to have, again, Canadian, especially Canadian cultural content for Canadians, right? Like, we may not see a really good documentary on the Inuit, as an example, pop up on our Netflix, even though it's a curated documentary. I understand the thought process there, but why is there this push to have it on all online streaming services, regardless if you're in Canada or not? To me, that just, it works against the idea of helping spread Canadian cultural content to those that are perhaps most invested in it, which would be Canadians and not necessarily Australians, those in the European Union, etc.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have no good answer for why the starting point for the regulator was that these discoverability obligations might be global in nature, Canadian and foreign. Yeah. It's just, it does, as you suggest, I don't think it makes any sense. Even on the domestic front, I think it is worth taking a step back to recognize that this is a little bit an old paradigm here. Even though and I realize, of course, there is just an incredible amount of content that can be hard to find in the in the digital world. The very notion of discoverability here is really a construct that comes out of the television world in Canada, where if we go back many years, Canadian broadcasters have had a significant advantage in the marketplace, and it's through a policy known as simultaneous substitution. The idea, and Canadians will be familiar with it, is that where a program airs on a Canadian broadcaster and on the US broadcaster at the same time, the Canadians see only the Canadian feed. So for example, if you're dealing with Grey's Anatomy, let's say, it's airing at a particular time in the United States, Canadian broadcaster, I think it's CTV, gets the rights to that. And if they ensure that Grey's Anatomy airs at the same time in Canada as it does in the US, then people will only see the Canadian feed. And that's even if they happen to be on the US channel on their as a subscriber. Right. Now that has generated hundreds of millions of dollars annually.
Right.
I realize it feels pretty outdated. It's not how people watch TV for the most part, but that certainly was for a time. But what that also meant was that Canadian broadcasters largely surrendered control over their programming schedule to US broadcasters. So that if the US equivalent moves Grey's Anatomy, the Canadian broadcaster is going to move it as well because they want to take advantage of this opportunity. And so who kind of got lost in the shuffle? The Canadian programs that these broadcasters were obligated to place, because they'd put them at one time. And if there was a change in the schedule, they'd move it. And so oftentimes very hard to find them. Now, of course, today it's almost all on demand. This seems like a boomer type conversation that doesn't make a lot of sense to some, but nevertheless, that was the way it was. The policymakers, the politicians have imported that kind of thinking, this idea that the problem with Canadian content is not that it is not sort of quality, is not the exportability, it's not all these other issues. It's that people can't find it. And if only they could find it, then they would watch it. And so the idea is we need to force a service like Netflix to ensure that people can find Canadian content, because once they do, they'll like it. The irony, just to close on this, is that Netflix is not like your cable company. One, they don't benefit, of course, from simultaneous substitution. But even more, nobody is locked into Netflix. You know, if you don't find anything to watch that you like to watch on Netflix, you can quit your subscription anytime you like. And so Netflix's entire their entire incentive is to ensure that people find content they want to watch. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a subscriber in Canada who you can tell, because Netflix algorithm is very good, you see that every time there's Canadian content, that's what they watch. Guess what? Netflix was going to provide them with more Canadian options. They're going to keep feeding them that because it's there's a demonstrated interest. So there is no incentive to hide any of this from Canadians. And it takes nothing more than just a basic search to find it. And yet, nevertheless, we've moved down the road to this kind of old style approach of let's force these guys to promote the Canadian content on their service. That's been the missing link for the kind of success we're looking for. Lastly, if you take that policy and you move it into a world of TikTok and YouTube, which the government and the CRTC proposed to do, well, there it makes even less sense. Yes. You don't know necessarily which TikTokers or YouTubers are Canadian. And if you begin to effectively force them to tinker with their algorithm, the real risk is that you're going to do more harm than good. And you may actually, you might promote them a bit more in Canada, but it might result in significant demotion globally, which for many creators is where the majority of their audience can be found.
Right. Michael, I know we have limited time. I wanted to ask you, stepping back from Bill C-11, I always ask myself this question in terms of who determines what Canadian cultural content is. For example, I can see if a documentary was on the Freedom Convoy as an example, a Canadian content creator could create it about an issue in Canada. But I could also see the government not necessarily wanting to highlight a documentary that's openly critical about their policy decisions during that time. Are we relying a lot on government to determine Canadian cultural content in this scenario?
We are, although I don't believe that the intent, and I know there's some that might disagree with me, I don't believe the intent here is for the government to try to limit people's access to content they disagree with or find uncomfortable.
Okay.
I think it is more broadly, the goal is to promote Canadian content. Now, what counts as Canadian content is a very thorny issue. And it's one that in the user content world, we have no definitions at all. And that even in the commercial space for film and television production, we have rules, but I think there is increasing recognition that they are not really fit for purpose. And so it's more of a tick box exercise. If you tick the right boxes, you're Canadian content. If you don't, you're not. Plus, one of those boxes has to be that a Canadian owns it. And so we're in this kind of weird situation where services like Netflix and Disney and Amazon are spending significant amounts of money. They're some of the biggest investors actually in productions in Canada. A number of their productions are productions that are Canadian in virtually every way. Canadian actors, it's a Canadian story, it's filmed in here, it's a Canadian crew. I mean, it meets everything except for the fact that Netflix owns it or except for the fact that Amazon owns it. And so then it somehow doesn't count. And so politicians get to claim these companies don't invest in Canadian content, leaving out the part where they actually can't, given the rules that require the ownership to be held by someone else. And so we need to, I think, have a re-examination of some of those rules. The government has indicated that will happen. And there may be an element here of be careful what you wish for because you just might get it, where opening that Pandora's box about what counts as Canadian may result, I think, in a modernization of those rules. And suddenly, those that think of Canadian content as excluding some of those large players will be forced to reckon with a reality where Canadian content can include content that is owned by and funded by some of these large international players.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense, Michael. Thanks for that. I wanted to now shift to Bill C-18, the Online News Act. There was some confusion as I was reading through the bill in terms of its intention and what it aspires to do. So I wanted to see if you could provide an overview of what Bill C-18 is. I know you yourself have actually gone before Senate discussing some of the criticisms or concerns that you have with Bill C-18, and I'd love for you to discuss that as well.
Yeah, sure. No, so I have devoted some of my podcasts to it and also appeared before both House committees and Senate committees on that bill and written a lot about it on my blog as well. So, I mean, the starting point is for this bill is something that I think most people can recognize as an issue as well. And that is the struggles that many legacy media have faced in a digital environment. One of the big revenue sources that was critically important to that sector, of course, was advertising. And in a digital world, much of the advertising has shifted over to platforms like Google and Facebook. Now, that shift has occurred not because of news, but rather because they simply offer a better targeted, more effective ad product, right? If you want to know people who are likely to listen to podcasts where they've got an open mind on a different policy issue, Facebook and Google can find that person for you. A conventional newspaper cannot. I mean, there might be some people that read that paper or watch that television program that meet that criteria, but they are not nearly as targeted. And so we've seen a big shift in ad dollars go to these digital platforms. But I think it's important to recognize that that shift is not a function of the availability of news on those platforms. It's the availability of a better ad product. Nevertheless, government looks at this issue and say, we've got companies that are making a lot of money, and we've got media companies that are not. And we recognize the importance of the survivability of those companies. We need to find a way to ensure that we've got a healthy media ecosystem. And so their basic approach is, let's find a way to force these large platforms to give money to the large media companies, or to media companies more broadly in Canada. And, you know, the position they take is that there may be some deals that have been already struck, but what we are going to do is require these companies to negotiate agreements with other media companies, all of this to be overseen by the broadcast regulator, the CRTC. If they can't reach agreement, we'll send it to arbitration, and an arbiter will decide what the fee will be. The problem is that you've got to have something to negotiate about. You know, what exactly would Google and Facebook be paying for as part of this? And what the government settled on effectively are links. They call it facilitating access to news. And so they say that the act of facilitating access to news is something that would require the party that is facilitating that access, namely the platforms, to pay to the media companies. Wow. Now, I must admit, I always get strange looks as if I must be making some mistake, because this possibly can't possibly be the way it is. But the reality of this bill is, let's take Facebook as an example. Publishers post links on Facebook to their articles in the hope of driving traffic back to the original publisher's source. And of course, they can then sell advertising, maybe get further subscriptions. The majority of the links that get posted on Facebook are posted by the publishers themselves. So they want that benefit of having essentially that free referral traffic back to their original sites. This bill says that Facebook has to pay the publishers for the existence of these links that the publishers are posting that is sending traffic back to the publisher. Facebook doesn't put a full text article, doesn't copy the article. It's merely putting sometimes the headline or the blurb, which would clearly be covered under fair dealing, under copyright, and is sending the person on to the back to the original site itself, or to the original site itself.
Wow.
And yet the government's position is that requires compensation. And the amount of compensation we're talking about is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Wow. According to some in the Senate, it could be as much as 30 to 35% of the news expenditures of every news outlet in Canada, newspaper, radio, and television. And so when faced with that, it should not surprise people that Facebook and Google have said, well, if the choice is link and be required to be part of the system and pay massive amounts of money for linking, or stop linking altogether, we're going to at least explore the prospect of not linking. And that's precisely what those companies have done.
Correct. Michael, this to me, again, I don't want to have a tinfoil hat on, but I can understand why large media corporations would want the government to do this, because it benefits them in the end of the day. But how could it not be seen that Google and Meta, and I'm going to use those two as examples because they're perhaps the biggest, how could it not be seen that they would not be in favor of this? It does not make sense to me that no one sat down and said, there's no way we're going to get Google and Meta on board with this. Let's temper our expectations and have a plan B in the event that they say, we are not going to stop linking. We're just going to not link that story as a result.
Well, I don't think it's not the story itself. It really is the way the law is set up, that if you link, you pay. So it's not about any individual story. It's in the aggregate. You're either in the system or you're not in the system, which is why they're going to have to remove themselves from the system if they don't want to be subject to it. For the options the government had, first, there were other options. For example, they could have required both of those companies to pay into funds. Let's say 2-3% of your digital ad revenue goes into a fund. We use that fund to fund journalism. That removes the issue of linking this to links. It removes the transparency concerns. It removes questions about who's eligible for this. It removes concerns that what you're doing is paying debt holders of large media companies rather than actually funding journalism. It removes some of the dependence that we have on these companies. I mean, it removes so many of the issues that it is, frankly, a bit mind-boggling that the government chose not to take that approach. Mm-hmm. Until you learn that, well, the truth is that some of the large media companies already have deals with these companies where they post full text. And so they saw an opportunity to get paid even more, this time for the links. And so they pushed that particular deal. How they sort of reached this point without realizing that this was a distinct possibility as an outcome, that these two companies might just pack up their bags and say, we're out of the news business. You know, in the case of Facebook says that only about 3% of people's feeds involves news. The majority of it does not. And that content is highly substitutable. In other words, someone will spend as much time on that platform looking at pictures from friends as they will at news articles. And so there's just not much economics in it for Facebook. But there is a lot in it for many of these media companies. And so at the end of the day, the media companies need Facebook far more than Facebook needs the media companies. And so we end up with this situation where the government lobbied heavily by the media companies, looking to curry favor with those media companies, hoping for favorable coverage, now find themselves in a very difficult position. Because at the end of the day, at this stage, there's the real possibility that they are going to walk away. And not only will there not be the big pot of gold at the end of the day, the $100 million from Facebook, let's say, but there may be the loss of the value of all those free links and exposure, which itself Facebook says, at least in their studies, is itself worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And so what the government has opened the door to is the possibility of a significant net negative. Not only are they not offering new money, but they may have created legislation, if this passes and if the companies follow through, that actually results in less revenues going to these companies, not more.
Right. And not only that, I think it's the public perception of media and government and the intertwining. And like you mentioned before, like the currying of the favors and the lobbying, that to me is the reputational risk as well that the government faces. But I'm not sure they're as concerned with that as they should be.
Yeah, I think there's no question, actually, that this raises, and this is a number of media players have raised this, this raises significant trust issues. You know, if we look at where the media is at, there are real trust concerns. And I don't think this helps. I think if anything, this really hurts. And if even if we take a look specifically at the government's incentives around this, and then the media's coverage of these issues, the media's coverage of the government on this issue raises, I think, trust concerns, because we've seen media essentially lobby and campaign, use their front pages, so to speak, to lobby for this legislation. And then once they get the legislation, they kind of back off. There are very few op-eds published in many of these media outlets that have been lobbying for this legislation that are critical of the legislation. And I think that ultimately really does undermine public confidence. You see is there is a willingness of the companies that say, you can trust us. We offer up reliable news, to at the end of the day skew their coverage for personal benefit. And I think that's really harmful.
I agree, Michael. And I'm curious to see where this goes and how this kind of plays out. Michael, I know we're at time, and I wanted to ask you just a closing comment for Canadians as a whole. You know, taken together with the Liberal Party convention policy, Bill C-11, and now Bill C-18, what should Canadians be wary of when it comes to what the government's trying to do? You know, I've never seen this kind of the numerous bills put forward in succession that in some ways discusses our online behavior. And I think there's a real ability here for Canadians to at least start asking questions about why these are being put forward so quickly and so readily in 2023.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think there is a real need for active engagement by the public on these issues. You know, I think the government, to a certain extent, thinks that, you know, they can get away with this, so to speak. You know, that the public won't pay attention. It's clear the government has been very responsive to lobby groups on many of these policies. And, you know, I think the more Canadians speak out, I'd like to think that that would have an impact. You know, if you take a look, for example, at Bill C-11, this one, I really, you know, coming back to regulating user content, I find it inexplicable that, you know, the minister kept insisting that there was no issue there. The public, the creators, many of them kept saying there is. It went to the Senate. Independent senators, they don't have a dog in this fight. They took a look at this and they came to the conclusion there was a problem. They propose a solution that meets the government's stated objectives for the bill and provides the kind of support people are looking for. And yet still with that, the government rejects that. Is it any wonder that there aren't people that believe that there are other motives or other intent behind all of this, given that they had the opportunity to address these issues and chose not to?
Michael, I just want to say on behalf of all Canadians, because I can't speak, I'm going to assume that I can. But I want to say, first of all, thank you for your public service on this issue. I really enjoy your Law Bites podcast. You've testified before House committees and Senate committees, echoing, I would say, concerns that more Canadians are and should be aware of. I think you, in many ways, are becoming kind of like a voice for a lot of content creators like myself who have concerns, and you're doing it in a very diplomatic way, one that's grounded in legal frameworks, understanding our constitutional rights perhaps better than most anyone. And I think that's a real public service, again, as more and more Canadian content creators are putting forward their ideas and their vision for the way forward. They're very concerned with these bills and policies, but they're just not sure how to go about it. And I'm so glad that people like you exist to hold the government on some level to account.
I do my best, and I'm grateful for, you know, for people getting involved, and grateful to you for the opportunity to come on and talk about some of these issues. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael. We've just scratched the surface, but I can't thank you enough for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Open Minds podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Balgren, and reminder, you can find me at www.openmindspodcast.com, on Instagram at Open Minds Pod, or on TikTok at Open Minds Podcast. Feel free to leave a comment, like, or follow. Send me a message. Let me know what you think of this episode, and I will definitely catch you in the next one.